Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to do another Classroom on the Air. That's where I take one topic that really has broad-based interest and go into greater depth. Normally, I open my program with the latest on health and nutrition, maybe giving 20 different tips on something. But on Classroom on the Air, I try to look at a very comprehensive issue, one that impacts tens of millions of Americans. In fact, this one impacts almost 100 million. That is the subject of diabetes. Then, after our break, we're going to hear from a journalist in Israel. He's Jewish, who believes that there are some injustices occurring, and he's addressing them. And he's not just giving us opinion. He's giving us the facts that we're not aware of in the United States, in part because the mainstream media will not cover anything from Israel in an honest and objective way. There's a great deal of political pressure placed upon them to toe the APEC line. I understand that. But if there's ever going to be peace, and I believe we all want peace, we want peace for the Jewish people living there, and we want peace for the Palestinian people living there. I don't want to see either side hurt. And if we look at what has happened over the last 60 years, it's not working. And we need to have a different perspective. This is just one more view of what is occurring. And then we will complete our program today by having a group of women who believe that they believe in Islam, they're devout Muslims, but they believe that the rapes, the honor killings and slashings and burnings, the child marriages, there's so many things that are done in the name of Islam that they disagree with, they take issue with. So we're going to hear from the authors of the Honor Diaries and to get their perspective on this. And once again, we're broadcast all over the world, all over the United States, and these are voices we have not heard before. So I'm looking forward to that segment. So let's begin. The subject is diabetes. I remember when I first started my practice, wow, almost no one suffered from diabetes. A lot suffered from heart disease and cancer. There was a lot of smoking back then. We don't appreciate how many people smoked. In my family alone, all of my aunts and uncles, every single one smoked. They were considered a moderate smoker at 2 packs a day, but many smoked 3 to 4 packs a day. My father and mother both smoked between 3 to 4 packs a day. My older brother smoked 3 to 4 packs. Now, of course, at the time they were doing it, when I would try to argue why they should be giving it up, they would argue, well, our doctor, family doctor, smokes. Everyone we know smokes. And if there was really a problem, Gary, the government would have stepped in a long time ago. I said, you know, the government has a position that it's not going to go after an industry if that industry is very influential with the government. And that's the tobacco industry. They're extremely powerful. Well, they didn't want to hear that. They just thought that was nonsense. And then, of course, my older brother developed later in life lung cancer, terminal lung cancer. My father, heart disease and stomach cancer. My mother, breast cancer and heart disease. Almost no one had diabetes because where I grew up, almost everyone did some form of exercise. They biked, they walked. In the summertime in particular, softball was big. They bowled, but they didn't like the idea of just being overweight. Today, being overweight is just considered normal. 1/3 of the entire American population is overweight. And we have enormous amount of obesity in addition just to being overweight. In fact, the newest report shows that 50% of all adults in the United States have prediabetes or full-blown diabetes. That's a huge number. You know, think about it. We are a country of of 326 million people, and we've got about 80 million people who are 18 or under. So you subtract 80 million from 300 and, let's round it off, 330 million, you're dealing with more than 250 million Americans are pre-diabetic or diabetic. To put it in perspective, that's more diabetics than you have in India at 1.3 billion people, or China, about the same number. According to the National Diabetes Statistics Report, the number of Americans with diabetes skyrocketed in just one recent year, with women comprising more than 50% of the cases. And researchers estimate that the diabetes population and related costs are expected to double in the next 25 years. Study after study has confirmed what many of us in the alternative community have known for years, that moderate exercise, changes in a healthy diet, meaning a plant-based diet, taking the right supplements, and de-stressing can significantly reduce the risk of this serious disease or reverse it. Now, what are the primary causes? Diabetes is closely associated with heart disease, and the incidence of both conditions increased when Americans began to change their diet patterns. The saccharine disease, written more than 40 years ago by Dr. T.L. Cleave, provided some observations that are relevant today. Among them, said the late Dr. Robert Atkins, who is a friend of mine, is the law of 20 years, quote, which says that after you introduce refined carbohydrates into a culture, two illnesses emerge 20 years later, diabetes and heart disease. We know that a third world diet without refined carbohydrates leads to no heart disease and no diabetes. When one illness emerges, so does the other. Studies of this sort have linked diabetes with heart disease. Under normal circumstances, insulin is released by your pancreas in response to elevated levels of sugar in the blood. It promotes the transport and entry of glucose at your blood sugar to muscle cells and to various tissues, and this allows the lowering of blood sugar levels. Now, in a diabetic, part of the process is interrupted as a result of a deficiency in or a resistance to or an insensitivity to insulin. For many years, it was thought that diabetes was purely and simply a deficiency syndrome in which the body did not produce sufficient quantities of insulin for proper glucose metabolism and assimilation. More recently, it's been learned that many diabetics do produce enough insulin, but their cells do not take it in. The problem, then, is due to insulin insensitivity or resistance. Now, what's that mean? Insulin insensitivity means that insulin enters cells at points known as receptor sites. And when the receptor sites are plugged because of fat, cholesterol, inactivity, or obesity, insulin cannot enter. As a result, glucose stays in the blood and creates hyperglycemia, or high blood sugar. And this excess sugar is diagnosed as diabetes. And in such cases, there is no need to increase insulin production, but rather a need to enhance insulin sensitivity. A person with diabetes needs to work at making his or her own insulin more efficient, and simply increasing the amount of insulin will not do that. And then you have what is called insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is a phenomenon that is closely related to insulin insensitivity. With insulin resistance, there's also a sufficient or even an overabundant supply of insulin, but allergic responses prevalent in the body prevent insulin from doing its job. Usually, allergies to specific foods suppress the activity and efficiency of insulin. And different factors may be responsible for a disordered carbohydrate metabolism in different people. Wheat, for instance, may create symptoms of high blood sugar in one woman, whereas corn may affect another. So offending substances can be determined on an individual basis with food allergy tests. Now, there's two types of diabetes. There's actually three, but only two are recognized. The third is what many consider diabetes of the brain or Alzheimer's. Type 1 diabetes is the most serious form of the disease. It used to be called juvenile diabetes because for many years it was believed that it only occurred in the childhood or teenage years. And this form of diabetes is characterized by a true insulin deficiency. It results when the pancreas is damaged from some exotic viral infection or even highly toxic states, and even vaccine can do this. The disease may also be a generic condition. In type 1 diabetes, the beta cells in the pancreas that produce insulin are destroyed. And since type 1 diabetes, and hence diabetics, have an insulin deficiency, they have to take insulin by injection daily and generally for life. Type 2 diabetes, also known as non-insulin dependent or adult onset diabetes, is more of an acquired disease. It's often precipitated by chronic excess of weight, poor diet, and lack of exercise. Now think about it. Think about the people you know, or maybe yourself. They generally come together. You rarely find a person who's exercising vigorously who's overweight. You generally don't find a person who is eating healthy who's overweight. And you generally don't find a person who is meditating, doing yoga, who is highly stressed. You also find that diabetes is more common in people who don't exercise, are overweight, and they're overweight because they're eating mainly an excessive amount of calories from bad food. It's just that simple. Thus, the form of the disease is characterized by complications in insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity, rather than, in most cases, a true deficiency of insulin. Type 2 in children was virtually unheard of until recently. Now, there are thousands of children diagnosed every year with type 2 or adult diabetes. In fact, there's a report from the American Diabetic Association showed that in just a 9-year period, the incidence of type 2 diabetes among American children and teens rose by 21%. And some non-diabetic women develop a type of diabetes called gestational diabetes during pregnancy, usually in the last trimester. So how do you know if you have diabetes? What are the signs? Well, often there are no symptoms present, especially in the beginning stages of type 2 diabetes. Obesity is sometimes a sign of pre-diabetic state, especially when the excess weight is concentrated at the waistline and just above the waistline. And classic diabetic symptoms are more often experienced as excessive or frequent urination, especially at night, and great thirst and hunger and fatigue and weight loss and irritability and restlessness. And progressively, the eyes, the kidneys, the nervous system, and the skin become affected. Infections and hardening of the arteries commonly develop, and that is not a good thing. Now, people can take the orthodox approach, but it's never cured a single person. I believe in taking an alternative approach because there has been a lot of cures. And I want to share some of the protocols with you. Then you can decide what you want to do. Now, I recently completed a 3-month health support group, and which was a lifestyle and behavior modification. People came on a regular basis for 3 hours. We had all their blood sugars and blood pressure and impedance tests taken. And for those in the group who were diabetic, there were also people with depression and anxiety disorders who came, and people with high blood pressure. But the diabetics were one of the largest groups. And with only one exception in the entire group of diabetics, they were all overweight. And many had depression, and many had problems of excess sweating, neuropathies, pains, and they didn't exercise. So the very first thing you got to do, you got to exercise. An exercise regimen is crucial for burning calories and nourishing your metabolism, it normalizes it. And it's especially important for overweight adults who are often inactive. Exercise also heightens the body's sensitivity to insulin. By lowering cholesterol, it lowers triglyceride levels in the blood, making cells more available for glucose assimilation. And this is why the insulin requirements of diabetic athletes always drop while they're engaged in swimming or soccer or other sports. Athletes also notice an increase in their insulin requirements when they cease doing their physical activities for an extended period of time. And athletes are not the only ones who benefit from exercise. 10 to 20 minutes of moderate exercise after each meal helps reduce the amount of insulin necessary to keep blood sugar levels under control. A brisk walk gets the body's metabolism working a little faster so that food is more easily absorbed. And that prevents blood sugars from rising too high. An exception to the rule involves patients with diabetes and heart disease. In these cases, exercise after eating may precipitate an angina attack because of the transfer of blood from the intestines to the legs and other parts of the body. Also, make sure if you're a diabetic or pre-diabetic, you get an allergy test to determine whether a specific food is causing your hyperglycemia. A doctor can monitor a patient's blood sugar before and after that food is eaten, and foods that raise the blood sugar cause allergic reactions and should be eliminated. And then there's some good supplements. Among the supplements that I feel are the best for diabetics would be alpha-lipoic acid, chromium, zinc, omega-3 fatty acids, the polyphenols, garlic, magnesium, ginseng, and enzymes, especially enzymes from like protease, amylase, lipase. Digestive enzymes would be very good. The herbs and vitamin C. And the herbs that are would include the plants that contain phytochemicals with anti-diabetic properties. That would be chicory, Indian snake root, thyme, safflower, Indian fig, dandelion, rice paper plant, jack bean, flax, barley, evening primrose, oats, and alfalfa. Now, plants containing phytochemicals with insulin-sparing properties include coconut and the common plantain. Also helpful may be prickly pear, cactus, aloe vera, fenugreek, and bitter melon. And there are ways that you can treat a diabetic ulcer naturally and with cleaning the area and then using a combination of Manuka honey with colloidal silver, which is very good. And also, you want to make sure that you're having smaller but more frequent meals, what I call grazing through the day, and on a plant-based diet. Foods you got to emphasize if you're a diabetic or pre-diabetic would be the nuts, the seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, sesame seeds, and chia seeds, also walnuts, almonds, pistachios, macadamias, pecans, they're all good. Sunflower seeds is particularly good. And make sure you're also getting juices. Now, you can have grapefruit juice, but not orange juice. You can have apple juice, and starting the day with some apple cider vinegar, a teaspoon, with lemon juice diluted with green apple and celery and cucumber and ginger juice is terrific. And look at chromium picolinate, 200 micrograms twice a day. Vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams five times a day. B-complex, 50 to 100 milligrams once a day. Vitamin E, 400 units twice a day. Calcium, magnesium citrates, 1,000 milligrams a day. Potassium, 300 milligrams a day. Manganese at 15 milligrams a day. Zinc at 20 milligrams a day. Quercetin at 1,000 milligrams twice a day. The essential fatty acids, 2,000 milligrams, 1,000 in the morning, 1,000 in the afternoon. L-carnitine, 500 milligrams twice a day. Inositol, 500 milligrams. Vanadyl sulfate, as directed on the bottle. Bitter melon, about 100 milligrams. Ginseng, about 100 milligrams. Aloe vera, about 2 teaspoons a day. Alpha lipoic acid, around 600 milligrams a day. Now, these are the things that make an enormous difference. But let's stop for a moment and take a look. What about coenzyme Q10? It also helps. 100 milligrams 3 times a day. N-acetylcysteine, 500 milligrams twice a day. Turmeric, about 300 milligrams a day. Evening primrose oil, around 1,000 micrograms, 1 milligram. And then try sea vegetables. Maitake, that's M-A-I-T-A-K-E, mushrooms. And then proteolytic enzymes. Make sure you're getting 30 to 50 grams of quality fiber a day. And DHEA, generally 15 to 20 milligrams if you're over the age of, let's say, 40. And then green tea, generally decaffeinated green tea, about 500 milligrams in divided doses, along with ginkgo at about this 100 to 200 milligrams. And black cumin seed oil, about 1 teaspoon in the morning, 1 teaspoon in the evening. Now, there are support groups out there, and I'm a big believer that people benefit by joining a support group, because maybe you won't be motivated on your own to exercise, but if you're exercising with another person or more people, you're more likely to do it. And once you start eating, going from a, let's say, a processed food diet, French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, bagels, all of the meat products, and you give those up and you shift over to a plant-based organic diet with lots of fresh water, and you got to keep hydrated throughout the day, that will make a tremendous difference. So there you have some of the items that you need. Now, when I look at the group that did the best in this latest health support group, it was the people who were motivated to exercise twice a day. It was the greatest success came from people who started putting some green juices in their diet, because the green chlorophyll juices are great for detoxification. So you need to detoxify. That's a big deal. So detoxification is terrific. I want to see you be able to get as healthy as possible. And then diabetes won't be the scourge that it is today. One of my friends didn't listen to me. For 30 years, he never listened to me. And just 3 months ago, he was bedridden with neuropathy. He was dizzy. His blood pressure is way low. His kidneys are not functioning. And he's only 60 years old. And he just is a physical wreck. And when he finally called me and said, I need some help, I said, why didn't you take any of the advice for 30 years? You wouldn't be in this situation. He said, oh. He said, I don't know. I just don't know. I guess it's because I'm resistant. I resist a lot. I said, yeah, but there's a cost to resistance. I said, when you don't exercise and you're resisting it, you're not eating right, you're resisting it, and you're not meditating and you're stressed and you're overeating and you're eating junk food, then it's inevitable that you're going to have a disease, whether it's diabetes or heart disease or obesity or cancer, it's inevitable. He's got that now. He's finally on his way. I put him on a protocol, and at least for the last week, he's been up and walking, and that's good. So let's try to help the people in our lives. Let's try to help ourselves. I'm Gary Knoll. That's our Classroom on the Air on diabetes. We're going to take a break and be back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Hope you're having a nice day. Now, we're going to listen to a journalist talk about something that we have not heard about at all in the United States. And it's not to inflame passions or tensions. It's merely to show that we are not looking for solutions. We are flaming the kind of passions that lead people to hate each other. And our goal is to have people respect each other, to coexist, which both the Jews and the Palestinians did for a long period of time. I think you'll find this interesting. It's in two parts.
Welcome to the Real News Network in Baltimore. I'm Kim Brown. Is rape used as a political tool in Israel to demonize and dehumanize Arabs and Palestinians? Last June, the Israeli public was shocked to hear of a girl with a mental disability who was reportedly raped by a Palestinian as an act of nationalistic violence. The girl has eventually confessed that her family pressured her to invent the rape in order to have a Palestinian boy arrested. In December, the Israeli Committee for Women's Rights held a debate on sexual offenses in joint Jewish-Arab communities. Now, the debate quickly deteriorated into incitement against Arabs. In a recent piece in Electronic Intifada, David Sheen reported that among the political parties who organized the debate is the Shaz Party, which is described as a very religious Jewish political party there. A senior member of the party, Amnon Cohen, has been arrested and was recently accused of receiving bribery in the form of sexual favors. A woman testified that she was afraid for her life if she refused to have sex with the former member of the Israeli parliament. And today we're joined with the author of the article, David Sheen. David is an independent journalist and a filmmaker, originally from Toronto, now living and reporting from the ground in Dimona, Israel. David has written for numerous publications, and he regularly speaks on U.S. college campuses and in European parliaments about his work, which focuses on racial tensions and religious extremism in Israeli society. And David's joining us today from Israel. David, welcome to The Real News.
Thank you for having me.
So, David, if you could describe for us, what is the culture of rape in general, and what does it mean in Israel? Mm-hmm.
Well, rape culture is a problem everywhere in the world that I know of, the places that I've lived and visited, where patriarchy, misogyny, where men control society and view women and their bodies as fair game, as essentially an extension of their own property. And this permeates culture. And it's a problem in North America, and it's a problem here in Israel. Now, unfortunately, what we see is that in Israel, instead of the government saying this is a major problem, we need to work at reducing the amount of misogyny and the amount of rape culture and incidences of sexual harassment and sex crimes. Instead, what we have is top members of the government committing these crimes, top members of law enforcement, top members of the judiciary, top members of regional councils, and people in society like university deans and the head of the largest bank in Israel, the president of Israel, on rape charges. So we see that throughout the top levels of society, there's serious sex crimes. And that sends a message to the rest of society. Well, you know, this is a normal way to act. And sadly, the only time it ever gets mentioned by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is if he thinks he can somehow blame rape on non-Jewish, non-white, non-Jewish people, specifically Palestinians and African refugees and other non-Jewish folk in the country.
So given the fact that, as you said, rape is prevalent throughout the globe and doesn't necessarily tend to be exclusive to one particular society or the other. But the issue with rape is that it is often underreported. So to your knowledge, what kind of data exists about the prevalence of sexual violence motivated by nationalism?
Well, this was the topic of the discussion in the Knesset in December. And essentially, members of the Knesset were stating, we have proof. In fact, there's a plague of Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arab men, who sexually harass and sexually assault women. Police representatives, representative of the Israeli police force, which by no means are suspect of being pro-Arab, but they were no evidence of this. You know, we talked to all our local police forces and they reported back to us that they see no incidents. But in fact, the level of sexual assaults in those mixed cities where you have both Jewish and Palestinian populations, the amount of sex assaults there is actually going down. That includes sex assaults in general and sex assaults committed by non-Jews. That was the police statement. And as I wrote in the article, the same thing happened 5 years ago, the last time that the right wing tried once again to convene a Knesset session to blame non-Jews. Police said, no, I'm sorry, we don't have any evidence of some kind of, you know, concerted attack by Palestinian people specifically trying to attack Jewish women as a way to get revenge or to, you know, harm Jewish people, and the weakest link, you know, women who are easy prey for sexual evidence of any of this. It's in the minds of racist lawmakers. And I don't mind also saying there are many groups in society who their ostensive reason to exist is to prevent Jews and non-Jews from being in romantic relationships. I know, you know, you had the film called Loving that came out in the United States just a few months ago about the Supreme Court Loving versus Virginia, how a white man and a black woman were not allowed to wed just a few decades ago in the United States. There had to be a Supreme Court decision to overrule that. It should be pointed out that in Israel, there, till this day in 2017, there's no way for Jewish people and non-Jewish people to marry in the country. So the incidences of Jews and non-Jews deciding to live their lives together is relatively rare to begin with. But even those few rare instances, they make racists so angry groups to patrol streets and in Israel and beaches and public places, and they get funds from the government to actively try to prevent romantic relationships between Jews and non-Jews. And these groups are the ones who, you know, put this idea out there that, oh, the only kinds of, the kinds of relationships are abusive, and therefore we're not, you know, we're trying to prevent these relationships from happening because we're trying to prevent abuse. But the ultimate reason is they want to prevent miscegenation. They've got a eugenics objective to have ethnic purity, and this is what they openly state. And sadly, they receive government funds to try to make this manifest.
So talk about the accusations against refugees from Africa who are also blamed for sexually assaulting Jewish women. How much validity should be given, or credence should be given, to these accusations? Because they sound like they could be somewhat politically motivated.
I mean, sure. Look, there's no question that no one is going to claim that the crime rate of any group in society is zero. Yes, there are rape crimes committed by Jews, non-Jews, Arabs, Africans, and that's going to be the case regardless. But police themselves will say that refugees have a lower crime rate per capita than native-born Israelis. So why then is the focus on non-white, non-Jewish folk? Well, again, it's a way to incite racism. And this is what we have seen for the last several years in Israeli society. And the way that this has become a factor, just look a couple months ago in the city of Petah Tikva. It's a suburb of Tel Aviv. And the incitement is so great against refugees and associating them with sex crimes, baselessly, I might add, that now we can have an Emmett Till-like situation where a refugee was walking down the street right outside of City Hall, and he walked past a group. And the reason why we know the details is because since it's outside City Hall, there are cameras situated there. And so we saw CCTV footage of what actually happened. So old black man just walking down the street, he sees three girls, three teenage women standing there. And, you know, they're, I don't know, 3 feet, maybe 5, 6 feet away from him. And he says something to them, you can't tell, but whatever. It's over in 10 seconds, he walks away. Words are exchanged for 10 seconds, and the man walks away. Within seconds, he's pounced upon by a group of young Jewish men, and they beat him for over an hour in front of City Hall. And it got to the point where they pummeled him to death, and to the point where he was unrecognizable. And the only way that his brother was able to recognize him is because years ago, when he fled the fighting in Darfur, he was maimed and he lost several fingers. And because that was the only way that his brother was able to recognize him, because his face was, you know, irrecognizable. So on the pure, the accusation that a non-white, non-Jewish man spoke to some non-Jewish girls, that was enough to set off a lynch. That's where, and since that time, the mayor of that city, instead of saying, wow, we got to stop this racism, just the opposite. Instead, he's rounded up African refugees in the city, and he's shut the electricity off to their apartments to banish them from the city. This is part and parcel of the way that Israeli society, but it does speak to the greater phenomenon of also, you know, insinuating that non-Jews are sex criminals and they should be treated as such.
And David, in the piece that you wrote about this, you write about the, quote, sex crime epidemic in Israel. So why does Israel have such a high rate of sexual violence, in your opinion?
Well, it's always difficult to actually measure sexual violence because, as many people have said, so much of it is unreported. So is it rising? Is it falling? Are just people talking about it more? Are they aware of it more? One thing is clear, and that the attitudes around sexual violence are very problematic. Something like 61% of Israeli men do not think that raping someone with who is an acquaintance is rape. Somehow they conceive of rape as only being a situation, I guess, where you're hiding behind a bush and you jump out at some, you know, complete stranger and physically assault them. They only conceive of that as rape. The idea that someone you've met a couple once or twice and then you socialize with them and then rape them, that they don't think of that as rape, which is, of course, it's ridiculous. It's rape in every single way. But that really speaks to the overarching problem of how sexual violence is categorized and even understood and acknowledged in society. So that being the case, the message has to come from up top. But when you have Benjamin Netanyahu himself working in an office that's full of sex criminals, when you have multiple former chief advisors to the prime minister who have been accused of sex crimes, some more than once, when you have the prime minister's spokesperson who's been accused of sex, prime minister's driver who's driving him from place to place, convicted of raping multiple women and young girls. The problem is that we do not have leaders. And when we have, you know, mayor after mayor after mayor who are going to jail for sex crimes, then yeah, we have a message from up top that women are for the taking. And unless we have a message from the government saying this is a national emergency, we need to snuff this out, we need to condemn this and make clear to our menfolk that women's bodies are not yours for the taking, and assaulting anyone, whether you don't know her, whether you know her, whether you're going to ever know her, that's a crime, and don't even think about doing it. We need to have that kind of messaging. Unfortunately, the message comes from the top, as we hear in Israeli society, the Ruach HaMefaked, so-called, which means the command, expressed in Hebrew, and that commander's spirit is that women's bodies are for the taking. Until we see a change from the leadership, from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, we can expect this sex crime epidemic to continue.
We're going to take a quick break right now. We've been speaking with journalist, author, and filmmaker David Sheen. He has been reporting on the issue of rape culture in Israel, also how racism impacts Israeli society. Stick around for part two. You're watching The Real News Network. Welcome back to The Real News Network. I'm Kim Brown in Baltimore. David Sheen still on the line from Israel. We have been discussing the impact of a rape culture and how it pervades Israeli society all the way from the very top tier of the political strata and how it also impacts women every day in Israel. So David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So talk to us about what has been the response from women in Israeli society. What about feminist organizations in Israel, such as the ones promoting the use of the term culture of rape? Do they get along with the incitement against Palestinians? Do they participate in that at all?
Well, I should say that the feminist organizations in Israel, including one of the representatives of the Rape Crisis Center, who was present at that very Knesset session that I spoke of earlier, and I wrote about in the article, they unequivocally say the problem is not Palestinians. The problem is throughout society, Jewish, Arab, rural, urban, it's pervasive, and the way to combat it is not to focus on one specific ethnic group. I can't say that women's groups who speak out about rape culture, no, they haven't been falling into the same trap of making sectarian claims. We see in response that there are protests, that in recent years, on occasion, you have feminist groups going out into the streets and protesting against rape culture. For example, we saw this most recently when the president of Israel, or former president Moshe Katsav, who was sentenced to jail for a number of years for sex assaults against several women, including rape, he was let off early. Even though throughout the entire trial and since then, and since his incarceration, you know, he has been very, you know, attacking the women who accused him and not crimes. But regardless, he has received, you know, His sentence has been curtailed by a third. So when last month he was released from jail, we saw protests like this. The very same day he's released from jail, yet someone who had killed their rapist was sentenced to 20 years in jail and will receive no reduction in their sentence. So on that day, yes, we had women come out into the streets and protest. But it doesn't seem to make a mark. The protests aren't especially large, and politicians haven't, you know, taken that and taken it to heart and done anything about it, unfortunately.
So can you tell us about the organization, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Lahava? So who are they, and what is the goal of Lahava?
Okay. Well, Lahava, their main professed goal is that they're an anti-miscegenation, to prevent Jewish people and non-Jewish people from having romantic relationships. Now, it should also be said that they are, the leaders of this group are openly and unabashedly Kahanists, meaning they're followers of Meir Kahana, that's the founding father of Israeli fascism, you could say, a politician who really is the leading ideological figure of the far right in Israel. But we should also point out that Lahava has the same top funder as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the Falik family. These are a group of a family of Americans who they are the largest contributor to the election campaigns of Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. They're also the largest contributor to the Israeli armed forces, and they are the largest contributor to Lehava, this anti-miscegenation organization. And this group, first of all, it should also point out they have some side issues too. They also attack Christians. They're also anti-Christian. They try to repel any instance of Christianity. If there's a Christian choir singing in Jerusalem, they will protest them and, you know, try to banish them from the public sphere. So they're also really trying to push ascension to the Temple Mount to conquer the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. But their main focus is anti-miscegenation. And to do that, what they do is they'll patrol, especially Jerusalem, where they've been very successful, Thursday nights, Saturday nights especially, and they'll walk around and they'll, let's say, walk up to a Palestinian person and they'll say, hey, do you got the time? Do you know what time it is? Do you got what? And the person, you know, not thinking anything of it, will just say, sure, it's so-and-so the time. And as soon as he answers them, the time is so-and-so, but it can be heard that he has an Arabic accent when he's speaking in Hebrew, then that tells them, ah, this person is a Palestinian. And so once they know that, then they attack them, physically attack them. And the idea is to banish all non-Jewish people, Palestinian people from the Jerusalem area with the ostensive objective of so that Palestinians and Jews won't socialize, because downtown Jerusalem, of course, Thursday night, Saturday night, these are nights when people are out in the street, walking in you know, public areas. And I, like I said, there's so much going against it. There's so little, few opportunities for Jews and non-Jews to actually socialize and meet. But even those few opportunities drive them mad, and to the point that they will, you know, police people's social behavior, and to the point where they will physically attack Palestinian people, so that when they decide, to, you know, when they're sitting at home on a Thursday night or a Saturday night, they're like, you know what, I feel like going out tonight, but I don't feel like getting my head kicked in. And in that way, they do that enough to the point where we see Jerusalem is eventually and slowly being ethnically cleansed of Palestinian people.
I mean, David, I mean, I have to ask this question. I mean, we talk about ethnic cleansing, and we talk about, you know, these campaigns to push for Jewish purity and anti-miscegenation groups that have connections to the prime minister and to the Israeli army. I mean, how is this different from what the Nazis did in Germany and in Eastern Europe with the Holocaust and this push for Aryan purity? I mean, the irony can't be lost on the Jewish people of Israel in these policies.
Yeah. Look, there are people in Jewish Israeli society who have been screaming about this, yelling about this at the top of their lungs for years and years and years, but no one ever listens. They never get play. And of course they are attacked. But here's the most, you know, classic example. Just 7 months ago, one of the top generals in the Israeli army, Yael Golan, it was on Holocaust Remembrance Day that's celebrated on two different days, but on the one in which it's celebrated in Israel, on Yom HaShoah, he said that when he looks around and he sees Israeli society looking more and more and more like Germany in the 1930s, not in the late 30s or in 1940s when there was actual genocide being perpetrated, but certainly in the run-up to that time, because those policies of genocide did not spring up, you know, just magically out of nowhere. They were built upon years of demonizing the Jewish population in Germany to the point where dehumanizing to the point where people were fine with genocide. So yeah, we do see in those years, and we see in recent years, top Israeli cultural figures, you know, ex-government figures, and now army figures who are saying, yes, I am scared. Our country is looking more and more like what to do. That's the touchstone in our culture, in world culture and in Jewish culture. That's what we know. That's a symbol of evil. And our society is exhibiting more and more and more of these racist manifestations. We're horrified by it. The problem is that no one is really listening, because there is a lot of reasons for people to adopt brand Israel, to want to believe that Israel is good. Well, if you want to believe that, you know, if you want to do good for Jewish people, just believing that Israel is good doesn't cut it, because what you're doing is essentially you are silencing voices of dissent. You're silencing voices that are speaking out about the problems of society. These problems aren't getting any better. We're talking about them in Hebrew, but sadly, no matter how much we speak, it gets worse and worse and worse every year. The scariest part is the youth are getting more racist than their parents. So when we speak out in English, instead of having our voices augmented, we're essentially said that, you know, we're anti-Semites, we're people here are trying to improve their society, trying to point out the problems so we can improve, but instead we have people silencing it and mainstream media just, you know, pushing it off the pages. Well, I don't think there's any way to show love to Jewish people, to condemn them to a society in which racism flourishes and gets worse from year to year. Of course, if you really care about Jewish people and Palestinian people and African people and others, you will speak out and you will augment the voice, the critical voices who are pointing out the problems in society so they can be improved. But I don't see that happening today or tomorrow. And with the Trump administration, it's hard to imagine that that's going to happen anytime soon. Perhaps what we'll see is people realizing, oh yeah, that's what y'all have been talking about all these years in Israel, warning us about how what society looks like when you know, ostensibly democratic society starts going off the rails. There were problems throughout from the very, very beginning, but Israel's dispossession of Palestinian people from even before 48. But in recent years, we just see it going off the rails. And I guess y'all in America are getting a little bit of a taste of that now with your pussy grabbing in chief president, and just a sense of what we're living under here. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And I know now you got to spend your time focusing on how to fix your society, but maybe take some words of advice. Don't wait till it gets worse. It's a problem and you need to speak out about it.
I think that's an excellent place to leave that. We've been speaking with David Sheen. David is an independent journalist and filmmaker, originally from Toronto, now living and reporting from Dimona, Israel. You should check out his work in a variety of publications, but his most recent piece appears in Electronic Intifada. David, we appreciate your time and your extensive reporting on all the these different complex issues that are impacting Israeli society. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for watching The Real News Network.
Very insightful. And again, our goal is not to condemn Israel and praise the Palestinians. It's rather to say both deserve to live long, happy, healthy lives. Both deserve to live in peace. That is our goal. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening today, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.
First I get cold, then hot, think I'm on fire, but I'm not. Oh, what a pain I've got, it must be love. There's nothing I can do, all that I want is you. Look what I'm going through, it must be love. It must be love, it must be love. I fall like a sparrow and fly like a dove. You must be the dream I've been dreaming of. Oh, what a feeling, it must be love. Something is wrong, all right, I think of you all night. Can't sleep till morning light, it must be love. Seeing you in my dreams, holding you close to me. Oh, what else can it be? It must be love. It must be love, it must be love. I fall like a sparrow and fly like a dove. You must be the dream I've been dreaming of. Oh, what a feeling, it must be love. I fall like a sparrow and fly like a dove. You must be the dream I've been dreaming of. Oh, what a feeling, it must be love. It must be love, it must be love. I fall like a sparrow and fly like a dove. You must be the dream I've been dreaming of. Oh, what a feeling, it must be love. It must be love, it must be love. I fall like a sparrow and fly like a dove. You must be the dream I've been dreaming of. Oh, what a feeling, it must be love. It must be love, it must be love. I fall like a